Today is World Humanitarian Day, and let's begin with you, Honorable. What does this day mean, and why is it important?
Actually, this day is a very important day, as is a day where we remember the heroes that from the various countries around the globe that they have actually left their homes and they had come to assist those who are affected from humanitarian perspective. So it's a day we really remember our heroes. We also appreciate them. So we also appreciate their countries. And it's also a day that we also reflect on how best we have to continue to help the humanitarian situation in South Sudan. And actually this year is a very particular and a special year because basically we have a lot of humanitarian issues to be addressed, disasters, and it's also a day as a government of South Sudan we have to say thank you to the people that has also lost their lives and to their countries and to their communities. And we say their life did not go in vain, but it is done. Actually, it went on a very noble job.
All right. We'll talk about all that as we continue with the program. Dr. Olu, recently you and a team from the government as well, the minister was there, went to Bor and went to Pibor and other parts of the country. Just briefly, let's look at the humanitarian situation in the country on this World Humanitarian Day. How will you describe the humanitarian situation now?
Okay, thank you so much, Sabit. The humanitarian situation in the country continues to unfold. And I think at the current time, we have a number of key issues which we are facing. Mm-hmm. As the minister mentioned, I think one of them is flooding. As you can know, like we under his leadership, we did visit Bor and people, like you said. Mm-hmm. And when you look around Jonglei, up in our state right now, we are beginning to have a lot of flooding. I mean, it's a season, but again, it's coming very early, and lots of people have been displaced, which is creating a bit of humanitarian crisis out there. Secondly, especially around Jonglei in Pibor, we've had issues around violence in which there were communal clashes and, you know, people were also displaced into, you know, internally displaced camps, which is also creating, you know, a bit of a problem. Of course, as you're aware, we have been having locust invasion around the country. Mm-hmm. And this has serious potential to result into humanitarian crisis. I cannot end, you know, at the WHO rep then without talking about COVID-19. Mm-hmm. This is a global pandemic. I think in South Sudan, we've had our own fair share of the problem. And here also, that is another crisis that we're facing. Interestingly, this crisis actually cuts across all the other crises because a lot of things around it, the movement restrictions, the things that we need to do actually constrain our ability to respond to the other three. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is in addition to the other challenges that we have in the country. Like, for instance, food insecurity continues to be a yearly problem around the country. Mm-hmm. So this is where we are in terms of the humanitarian situation in the country.
Thank All right. you. Yes, Honorable Ministers, you visit your people in Bor and Pibor. Just give us a picture of what you saw. What was it like to be there?
Well, I think it was, well, first of all, I will say it's just not a great experience, but actually it was good that this high-level team from the government, the donors, and international community, and the humanitarian, we were there. So now we could really tell out of experience. We know what it means and how people lived when we talked about the internal displaced person that are in Bibor. Mm-hmm. So we have seen it for ourselves. We have experienced. So it's not just going to be a report on a paper, or just a mere talk show on the radio. Mm-hmm. It's something that we have seen it, we have felt it, and we have witnessed it for ourselves. So when we talked about the flooding in Bor, in Jonglei, in Mer, and other areas, so we basically know where the dike has broken, even the level of water, because mm-hmm. all of us, me and Dr. Ola, we were in that water. And so we basically know out of experience, and that's actually has actually strengthened our response as humanitarians to the crisis that that we are apparently in.
Yes, so knowing about the situation is one thing, and doing something about the situation is whole different thing. Now that you know the situation on the ground, as a government, as a Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, what next? What will the people of Bor and Pibor and all those areas that you visited, what should they expect?
Of course, it's good. Knowing the situation is one thing, but basically it helps you to understand the urgency and the commitment. So the visit has actually committed not just the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, but the entire government, including the presidency, to a certain major decisions. I remember we just returned back from Yungle, and then the presidency, under the leadership of President Salva Kiir, had declared the state of emergency in the very day, the next day when we came. This is because basically our being there, it has made us be more committed. It has made us to take more responsive actions. And I think as a government now, we have declared a state of emergency in Jungle. And not only that, we're going to take more actions. So it's basically because as a government, we don't tell what we want to do as per now. But we have a major plan. And we're really willing, and we're working closely across all the other clusters and sectors to address all the challenges that we face as humanitarians. And basically, I will echo certain of those challenges later during the discussions. And not only that, of course, we were there. The food were being distributed when we were there. It's not just a mere visit.
Okay.
The food distribution was happening. The distribution of non-food items were happening. And also the mobilization of the youth to work on diet. And not only just on humanitarian, because we had all other, we had others, because, you know, to prevent the flooding and manage the flooding, it also goes beyond the humanitarians. So on that process, we also have other players on the game. But despite that, we are more focusing on the humanitarian aspect of the crisis in Yungle.
Yes, Dr. Olu, just briefly, as the minister did mention, there was a state of emergency that was declared, particularly in Jungle State. What does this mean when it comes to humanitarian response?
What it means is that we really, the problem is getting out of hand, and for us to get it under control, we need to scale up the response. And when I mean scale up the response, that means all aspects of it. Of course, to mention that a lot of work is ongoing already, like the Honorable Minister said, we have over and above our ongoing humanitarian response, we have actually fielded in, you know, additional support, you know, to beef up the people we have on the ground. So we have sent teams to the different locations. They are doing assessments. They are providing food. They are providing shelter. They are helping with the water and sanitation situation. They are providing health and, of course, a lot of issues around protection and all that. So our guys are on the field working. But with this new declaration now, it means we really need to up the game in terms of, you know, the way we respond to the situation.
Now, when it comes to humanitarian response to a situation in a country, whose work is it? Is it the government and then the humanitarian organizations come and help, or it is purely the organizations to help and the government do a supervisory role?
Okay, Sebit, it's a sovereign country, and I think the primary responsibility is with government. Now, we work directly with government to support the efforts of government. And that is why the Honorable Minister actually led the team, and we had a full team of humanitarians, donors, NGOs that went with him. We did a joint assessment, and I think on the way back, we did agree on what the problems are and what the government will do. And I'm happy that the government declared it.
The
state of emergency. And we're working with them to really understand the implication and how do we then support the government to make sure that we implement all the action that needs to be implemented.
Yes, because I asked that question because the Honorable Minister is here and I would like him to answer this. We've had a lot of these humanitarian crises. One day breaks out, the whole call is, you know, we call on the humanitarian organizations to respond. We call on the humanitarian organizations to come and help us here. What is the government putting in helping these affected populations?
Thank you. First, let me echo key factor that it's the prime responsibility of a sovereign and independent state to take care of its own citizen. And that's why the government structure has a Ministry of Humanitarian and Disaster Management. However, a reality or the fact in the ground that South Sudan is a country that depends on donor funding. And this is due to the fact that the country has been at war. And then the other factor is that as a government, the other responsibilities that comes across. And if we are to look at the disasters and how we manage them, you may find that even about 90% of the resources of this country or of the government will have to go for that, for humanitarian response and disaster management. That means on the other side, the government also have a responsibility to take care of other governance institutions, security also sector, and development and infrastructure, because people need those services. So we have a gap. And I want to assure you that the government will make a commitment sooner or later, whatever how little it is, as a response to this virus. The first steps we have taken is to declare the state of emergency and then look at our chest, what we do have. And that angle, that's why as a government we always call on our friends, on our donors and international community for humanitarian assistance. Because basically, if you throw in or you find yourself in a river and you cannot swim, you have no any other options apart from
calling for help.
Yelling for help. And this is basically, this is what we're doing now. But as we're calling for help, the government will definitely take all the necessary actions in order not to create that conducive environment so that the humanitarian assistance is delivered. And the government is really, really very appreciative for the humanitarian workers. The humanitarian job is done on behalf of its own citizen. And that's what I can say on the behalf of the government.
Yes, and how long will the government, of course, keep relying on other humanitarian organizations?
This goes concurrently with three factors. One factor is that as long as the country is going to experience a permanent peace, that means the certain money that will go into security sectors could be diverted to other areas. So peace is a key. And then also, as we have this political stability at the level of democratic, I mean, generally about governance, let me not narrow it to democratic institutions, but about governance. So once we have improved our governance, we will find ourselves gradually, we will be able to reduce the level of calling for help and assistance. So they are connected all together.
All right.
As you know, of course, we had just worked very hard to make sure that the country had peace. And even the fact that still we do not have state governments in place is also a major factor. It's affecting us and it's affecting the local government. So basically, as humanitarians, we have difficulties in operations in certain areas because we do not have a whole complete state government that's in place. So once we have those kinds of, when we have good governance, we have peace, then sooner or later, I don't know, maybe it will be 50 years or 10 years or 5 years, whatever time, then South Sudan will not be called. But the practical things that we have now, we have major disasters that's affecting the country, and we need to really respond to it. And that's why in this kind of a day, the World Humanitarian Day, is a day that we give appreciations and thanks to the humanitarian work that had been delivered to people of South Sudan.
Yes, and Dr. Olu, you like to come in there on much of the work being done by humanitarian organizations. How far and how long can this continue? There is a saying that you teach a man how to catch fish instead of all the time providing for the person a ready-made fish.
Okay, well, as you know, the humanitarians have been here even before independence. I remember myself in 2005, I was here in Yale, up in our state. Our mandate is that as long as there is a crisis, humanitarian crisis, we have to be there to support government to prevent, you know, excess mortality. Mm-hmm. And we will always be there. But of course, as part of our mandate as well, we like to work with government to address some of the underlying causes of the crisis, so that, you know, we can move, you know, from humanitarian response more into longer term development. Mm-hmm. And I think here in South Sudan, we have started a discussion with, you know, the different sectors. How do we move from the daily, this issue of yearly humanitarian crisis to more longer term solutions? And I give you an example of the flooding. I think when we traveled, we had a lot of discussions about what we need to do now in the short term, mm-hmm. which we're already doing, but what do we need to do in the long term? The Honorable Minister spoke about the dikes. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure that those dikes are well constructed such that mm-hmm. we don't have this perennial, you know, flooding anymore? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is the way it works. We will, you know, continue to support, you know, as long as there's a crisis, because it's a mandate. And like the Honorable Minister said, if you have a country or an individual, a community or a set of people mm-hmm. whose capacity to cope with a crisis has been overwhelmed, I think it's moral that, you know, the global community, global humanitarian community, will come in to support them as they assist them, you know, to get back on their feet.
Mm-hmm. Now, this year's theme is about, you know, the real life heroes, those who are in the field, those who are sacrificing their lives. And it's also a day to pay tribute to aid workers who risk their lives and those who have been killed. In South Sudan, we've quite had a number of aid workers who have been killed over the years. Just go through some figures on, let's say, this year, last year, in the last 5 years, how many aid workers have we lost, and what needed to be done to ensure that aid workers are protected and they can be able to deliver the humanitarian service that is required of them?
Okay, I think so far this year we have lost about 8 humanitarian workers in South Sudan. Of course, in various circumstances, there have been quite a number of, you know, attacks on our assets and on some of our people as well. Some people have been injured as well. Mm-hmm. This for us is a big concern. Already, the humanitarian workers are working under very difficult conditions, and we really need to ensure that we guarantee their safety. Also, importantly, we guarantee the safety of our assets. Now, I just want to echo one of the things which was said by the Honorable Minister. I think one of the overriding issues for us in this country is the security. Mm-hmm. And with peace, we'll have that security. We're happy that, you know, the revised peace agreement is being implemented, but we're still having pockets of insecurity in the country which needs to be addressed mm-hmm. if we're going to guarantee the safety and the security of our humanitarian workers. Not only the humanitarian workers, but also, importantly, the community we are here to serve. I think this is really, security is a major issue that we need to address there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Honorable Minister, as a government, of course, and working with the humanitarian organizations with some of these particular challenges that they face when it comes to insecurity and sometimes access to other places, you know, sometimes denied. As a government, what are you doing to ensure that the work of the humanitarian organizations can actually be as smooth as is expected of them?
Yeah, of course. One of the things that we're working on as a government now is to make sure that we know among the challenges, as Dr. Ola mentioned, is COVID. And COVID has really affected the lives of people. Mm-hmm. And however, certain restrictions that has been put in place as a preventive measures, of course, it has actually hampered so much our operations. For example, I'm speaking to you now, but maybe tomorrow I have to be in WOW. Mm-hmm. So I may not have the time for Q14, but of course, there is an issue there. It has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. I was in Jungle then the other day. Again, I will have to be in Warab. So we need actually to maintain the regulations, the social distance that we keep, wearing face masks and other regulations by the World Health Organizations. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, certain restrictions has to be lifted so that we could be able to to respond effectively. Because if we are not in the ground, we cannot help those who are suffering. And so our operation is not just sitting in the office doing the paper job, but we also have to be on the ground in and out, so that at least we understand the level of response, what we want to respond to, and the best approach how to respond. That's one of the things. The second thing as a government is basically, for instance, in Jungla right now, because we know the crisis that we have there, it's caused by two disasters. Of course, we have flooding as a disaster, communal conflict. And as a government at the high level, communal initiative, I mean, the government has said high level, tax force that is headed by the vice president in order to address the community issue. And this, at least now, the violence have subsided. And once there is a communal violence, a political violence, we, the humanitarians, get affected in one way or the other. And that's why we had always been advocating that there should be their peace, there should be their settlement, and conflict resolution should be addressed. And that goes with my basic principles of a non-violence approach to resolve a problem in South Sudan.
Yes, we have talked about Bor and Jongle particularly, and we have a picture now of what the situation is like there because of the flooding and also because of the conflict and the communal fights that's happening there. But what is the situation like in other parts of the country, let's say in Unity State, let's say in Eastern Equatoria, for example, and other parts of Western Equatoria and Central Equatoria? And Dr. Olu, how is the humanitarian situation in these places?
Yeah, like I said, the humanitarian situation continues to unfold. I think in Upper Nile State, we are having pockets of communities that are also experiencing flooding. Of course, in some of these places, we also have the long-standing, you know, this chronic issue of food insecurity, which actually has been on, you know, for quite a while. When you look at the Equatoria, especially Eastern Equatoria, it's also a high-risk place, you know, for flooding. That is a flashpoint for us, and we really, you know, need to keep, you know, our eyes on. Like I said, also COVID is around the corner, and if you look at the distribution of the disease, it's all over the country now, all the 10 states. So not only Unity, Juba, or somewhere. So this is another major challenge that, you know, we really need to you know, start to focus on in terms of you know, our humanitarian response.
A lot have been said when it comes to humanitarian assistance, particularly, and I would like you, Dr. Olu, to just break it down, make it us understand. When we heard about millions of dollars being donated to a country like South Sudan, we hear like $22 million donated for humanitarian work. Where exactly does this money go? How is it work? How does it work?
Okay. We do have the frontline agencies. They are the ones that do the day-to-day implementation. And for these agencies, they need to do a lot of things. We have spoken about security. They need to secure their staff. They need to move their staff out to the field. They need to accommodate them. We need to procure large amount of supplies, and we do it's massive what we procure in terms of food, medicine, non-food items, water and sanitation equipment, and supplies and all that. Of course, this usually is sometimes channeled bilaterally, but some of it is also channeled through, you know, the South Sudan Humanitarian Fund, and it's then distributed, you know, to our
implementing partners.
Of course, all of this we do in coordination with the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs. So we do have what we call the Humanitarian Coordination Forum, which is chaired by the Honorable Minister. It does coordinate all the partners working and, you know, hold them accountable for what needs to be done. Of course, importantly as well, our accountability also goes to the recipient, you know, to make sure that we are able to provide them with all what they need.
Others will argue that actually the recipients will get a very tiny percentage of what was donated. The rest of the money goes for salaries of these aid workers, going for their accommodations, goes for their R&R, and all that kind of things associated with. Most of the money actually go back to the organization than to the recipient, who is supposed to get the benefits of these donations.
I don't think that is true. Because when you see the amount of procurements that we make, maybe some of them are not things that we publicize, but the amount of the
But maybe you should, because of accountability.
Okay, maybe then we need to do that a bit more. But for instance, if you see the amount of food that, you know, WFP brings into this country. It's massive. But then you can't just bring in food just like that. You need to truck them into the country. You need to fly some of them to some of the locations. To fly those planes, you need pilots, you need people. So it's an operation. Unfortunately, given our circumstance in South Sudan, it's an expensive operation. We recognize that. But importantly as well, it's a whole process. I mean, if you bring in food, let's say, into Juba, you cannot just put the food in a warehouse. You need security for the food. There are people that will administer the food, make sure that it's well kept and all that. So it's a whole process, and I just want to assure you and, you know, assure the general public that most of the money that is coming in actually goes to the actual service delivery. I give you another example for health. Can you deliver health without healthcare workers? No, we can't. So we need to recruit healthcare workers to make sure that they are the ones that provide the service. Now, most of the people, 90% of the humanitarians in this country are actually South Sudanese. And they are people, and part of the whole process as well is to build the local capacity so that, you know, when the internationals go, when a lot of these NGOs go, then we have local capacity that's able to then continue to work with government to respond.
Right. Okay. Honorable, you'd like to respond to that? When it comes to accountability of aid or humanitarian work in the country?
I think, I don't know about the past, but under my current administration, my job is basically to monitor, hold them accountable. And that's why we all went to the field together. And so basically, in most cases, this, you're right, I think, and everybody's right. Some previously, there had been there a scenario whereby the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs just get a merely report, and that's basically on the paper, the actions on the grounds is different. But under my administration, is different, is that I have to see for myself, because seeing is believing. And that's why, for instance, when we talked about the nutrition, is one of the that's a major sector when we talked about washed. So we really going to have a very effective coordination in terms of the result, the input. Yes, for us, we're not really there after the money. But we are after the results.
Okay.
And I think we have started very well. And not only that, we're reviewing the country agreements with the various NGO. And that country agreement definitely is part of the implementation of the NGO Act. And so far, I think with the current administrations within the ministry itself, things are different. So we have visited with him we have seen the nutritions that the situations of the children, the malnourished children that are in Bibor. So we are really doing a very close monitoring together. And we are not just working, of course, being suspicious between us and the humanitarian situation. That is, but basically, both of us, we have one agenda, we have one objective, is to deliver
great services to the people. Yes, I would like us not to end this interview before we talk about COVID-19, which is one of the recent crises that is affecting the whole world. And of course, as we give the theme of this year's about real life heroes, these are people, health workers, serving people, and also putting their life in danger. Others have lost their lives, others have recovered, thank to God. Now, Dr. Olu, here in the country now, if you look around, possibly if you go around, move outside, you're seeing every day the number of people wearing masks reduces. People no longer really take seriously the measures that were given by the World Health Organization and also by the Ministry of Health here. Can we say that we are still at a very higher risk like before than now? Because it's like people are now relaxing all the measures and in this way putting more humanitarian workers at risk.
Yeah, true, Sabit. We are actually, I mean, as we see now, people are beginning to relax when it comes to COVID, which is not the right thing to do at the moment. Globally, it is still a challenge. In South Sudan, for us it is still a concern. Even though we are reporting, you know, lower number of cases now, we believe that if we test more, and we are testing, you know, more in the states, we're going to have more cases. So we need to really continue to remind the communities. And we're doing that on a daily basis. We're having a lot of risk communication messages. We're having a lot of community engagement with, you know, the various communities. We are advocating to government, you know, to help us, you know, reach out to the community. Of course, importantly as well, if we're telling people to wear face masks, they must be available.
Absolutely.
So we are also working with the ministry to ensure that the high-risk population, especially those in the IDP camps, the POCs, and some other, you know, high-risk group, we manufacture, you know, masks and we give to them. Of course, you agree with me that one of the most difficult things in life is to change behavior.
Absolutely.
And for us, the whole idea is that we want to change people's behavior, but that takes a bit of time. And I believe that we will get there. It goes beyond COVID. It's, you know, telling people to wash their hands. This is a very basic hygiene thing. Absolutely. That even without COVID we need to do. But it takes a bit of time to do that. Apart from the messaging, we are also looking at, okay, if we tell you wash your hand, for those who cannot afford, we give them soap and we make sure that they have access to the water. So it's work in progress. And I want to seize this opportunity to appeal to our listeners and to the communities. COVID-19 is still very much real in this country. We need to keep, you know, the public health and social measures. Let's avoid, you know, gatherings. Let's wear the face mask. Let's wash our hands properly. And let us pass on the message to as many people as possible.
Honorable Minister, on COVID-19, how will you describe the response so far, especially the humanitarian response on COVID-19?
Thank you, Sabit. COVID is really an issue as we speak now, because basically, you have seen the behavior of our people is very practical. And even though the fact that some have recovered out of it doesn't mean that everyone can recover. And so we still to push up with the risk awareness, because the risk awareness will be more effective. And that's why, as a Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, in our first 100 days action plan, we started with the ministry itself. They start from all from the junior top to the minister, and we had about 3 workshops, and basically just to deal with COVID, because it's very important that we as humanitarian, we have to protect ourselves so that we could be able to protect and help others. So in short, Sabit, COVID is still a major issue.
All right. If you just join us, you're listening to the Miraya Breakfast Show, and I'm glad to tell you that my guest in the studio, we have Honorable Peter Mayen Majoldid, who is the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, and we also have Dr. Olusayo, who is the World Health Organization representative in South Sudan and also the acting humanitarian coordinator. We've been discussing and looking particularly on the World Humanitarian Day. Let's take 2 callers. If you have questions for my guest, please don't hesitate. Hello, good morning. Your name, please, and where are you calling from?
Manoj George from Sibir William.
Marhabek, Manoj. Ana kwez, marhabek.
Shukran kitira, Sibir William. Jika barraan kwez lel kullu manaz reiz bita manazama wa lektor bita ana fi sire. Suwal bita ay bimshilo me kwez Sibir William. Taban yao kullu dekatera malian Sudan. Utaniyan tu manazamaan fi jinnab Sudan. Yao mahalad al-mutasirin na hulud yani manazamaan. Tarak surah. يوم التنفيذ بتاعه كلهم قلبه ما جالش أنا لم هناك تأسيسات يعني في خدمات للأفعان هناك أنا بقول كده سبت ويليام طبعا منظمة يعني هم كتير في جنوب السودان ولكن يعني كان في حاجات تأسيس زي المفروض الله كله مواطنين يعني مال الموية ده مش مهم شديد ودكتور وأقوم بتاعنا بيعملوا لنا كمان يا وفر الأمن لما للدكاترة لكل الناس هناك كل جنوب هناك ولكن حاجة واحد بس يعني كدمات يعني في جنوب السودان منظمات قاعدين ولكن يعني لما يكون في حالة طائر كده مفروض يمشي ولكن بمشي بعد الكلام الناس ما عطوا شنو
Well, Manu Georgi, there's concern is that we have a lot of organizations, humanitarian organizations in the country. We have a lot of, we have the government as well, but they normally come in when there is a problem. Like when there's shortage of, when there's flooding like this, they only come, meaning they're more of response than prevention or preventing those things from happening. What will you, how will you respond to Manu Georgi?
Well, I just want to say that we are present here at all times. If you remembered when I started, I said over and above what we have in place. So we do have the humanitarian organizations all over this country at all times, and they have been here for a long time. We have ongoing programs, you know, looking at, you know, what we rightly said, prevention, looking at ongoing service provision. We have, you know, several national and international NGO providing services on a daily basis. But then when we have a crisis like this over and above the usual situation, then we filled in more people. It doesn't mean that we are not there, you know, before.
All right. Honorable Minister, we've come to the end of the Miraya Breakfast Show for today. On this World Humanitarian Day, what will be your final remarks or message out there?
Thank you. Just to let the, in response to Manut, I wanted to say that the ministry has a department of an early warning. So basically, it's not just a disaster time. So we basically, we do the earlier warning. That means basically we study the expected crisis, disaster that is expected to happen before it happens. And when it happens, we also have a disaster management department. In this World Humanitarian Day, I wanted to say that that we're paying the attributes as a government to the aid workers that have risked and lost their lives in delivering humanitarian services. And we rally on their support. We actually also paying attributes to their various countries, and also we also saying that we will continue to deliver the humanitarian services that is needed, and we urge the community to work together with the humanitarian workers, give them the respect, so that we could be able to help them and serve them better. And it's a day that's very important to us as a humanitarian.
Thank you, and thank you so much, Honorable Minister. Dr. Olu, what will be your final remarks or message out there?
Okay, thank you very much, Sabit. I want to really give two key messages here. One is to the affected population, to say that we remain committed to work with government to make sure that we address their needs. But importantly as well, we need their support. We need their collaboration to be able to help them. I think that is very critical. Two, I want to say to my to the humanitarians all over this country, and we have thousands of them dotted all over the country, we are in solidarity with you. We will continue to ensure that we work with government to protect you so that you're able to do your work, you know, in a free and a safe, you know, environment. And lastly, to the government of the Republic of South Sudan, I want to commend the minister. He's done a lot of work with us to ensure that we have access that we need. I want to just call upon the government to ensure that, you know, all this issue of access is addressed, especially the COVID-19 travel restrictions. We address the issue of security so that we can move around. And importantly as well, our donors, we need additional resources. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Olusayo, for coming to Mirai Studios. We do appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Honorable Peter Mayen, the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs. We do appreciate your time of coming here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.